My name is John Keith, and I'm an alcoholic. I say when I'm in California, I say I'm from the outside group because I live next to a prison. And sometimes if you just say you're from Chino, everybody gets nervous. They think that you climbed the fence to get to their meeting. But I knew that that wouldn't have any meaning to you folks. I can't believe this. You know, my qualification for being here and for receiving all of this honor and praise is that I was a failure at life. And, this is the only organization that you have to start out at the bottom. I walk around these halls talking to everybody that I could corner. And you know, it's amazing if you listen to the conversation between two alcoholics. I met one, he had a Florida tag on. He said his name was Jim. And he said, "You're from California?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You know where Ojai is?" And I said, "Yes. It's a beautiful community." He said, "I did time up there in the county jail." And you know, if you was at some big convention, that's probably not anything you'd be telling people about. I never get nervous. I just get panicky, and I drink a lot of water because my mouth gets dry. But I went on a small convention of 32 alcoholics, and we went to Mazatlan, Mexico. And it's always been my dream. I used to dream this way when I drank sweet wine and I'd read those Outdoor Life magazines. I always dreamed about doing things like catching a sailfish, you know. And of course, if you drank enough of that sweet wine, you could catch one without even getting out of the house. I did. I got to go. I couldn't believe it. Next thing you know, there's six of us alcoholics on this charter boat, and we're going out into the blue Pacific, and we caught sailfish. I couldn't believe that either. But you know, on the it's quite a boat ride to get out where these fish are, and we talked. And one fellow I talked to, his arm was just completely scarred up from the wrist up to his elbow. He had sawed at his arms, I guess, over maybe 10, 12 years trying to let out his life's blood. And there was a gal on there who had been in mental institutions for, I think she had made 9 trips. And she'd gone through these things like shock treatment. And I told my story, and we told our stories. And you know, luckily the crew were Spanish-speaking. They couldn't understand English. But I know if they knew what they had, they would have jumped over to the side and swam for it, you know. But anyway, this is probably one of the highest honors, I guess, if you could call it that. Actually, I feel like I'm with my family. I'm at a family reunion. But I've had George back there. We've corresponded, and I tell you, I can't believe the red carpet that you people rolled out for me. It's mind-boggling. They've taken me out, and I've eaten like I've never eaten before. Every night I've OD'd on some kind of food. The only thing, and I know we only live for today, but can you imagine what my life is going to be like when I get back to Chino on Sunday night? What a shock. Tonight I had prime rib and shrimp. And when I get back to Chino, it'll be one of those TV dinners in the microwave, you know. And that's going to be hard to take. Anyway, I drank less than 10 years. I was what they call a user, boozer, and loser. And my wife drank longer than I did. My wife is an Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have one of those long 40-year stories. What it was, I just couldn't stand that fun anymore. I think if I... two more weeks of fun would have killed me, I know. Maggie said, and gosh, what a beautiful gal. And she's right here, too. Luckily for me, she's pulling for me. But Maggie said that I was Irish. I actually was born in California. My dad was born in Colorado, and my grandfather was born in Cork, Ireland. And Denny was a daily drinker. My dad was a daily drinker. And Denny drank till he's 91. And I wasn't around him too much. I was raised with him for a while. I drank with him. One time when he was 80, I got drunk with him. And my grandfather was still getting in fist fights when he was 80. He wasn't winning any, but you know, my dad was a happy-go-lucky drunk to where we could, when my dad, there was five kids in the family, and when my dad was drinking, us kids would run to him because he was happy and he was singing. And we liked to be around him. We could put our hands in his pocket and get money. And he didn't mind. And in fact, when we heard my dad whistling, we'd run to him and roll him. And he wouldn't drink on Sunday morning, you probably know the reason why, because on Sunday morning he wouldn't drink because he was going to go to Mass. And on Sunday morning he was dangerous. I'll tell you this story because I'll share it with you because, and my wife lots of times said, why do you remember that junk? Well, that's why I'm in AA, because I can remember it. And this particular morning, I was to make my first Holy Communion. I was less than 6 years old. And this was a big day. I studied the catechism. I was in a small town. It was in Seal Beach. Seal Beach is just a white spot in the road. And on that particular day, I remember my dad put us all in his car, and we headed for the church. And on the way to church, I reached down alongside of the seat, and I don't know why, but I found a peanut. Us kids had dropped it in there. I found that peanut, and I ate it. And that don't sound like any big deal, does it? Well, I think some of you out there know the rules. And I was supposed to fast from midnight on. So I should have told somebody about it. I should have, I wasn't about to tell my dad. That was Sunday morning. But I went ahead and I received the sacrament because I was afraid not to. And you know what? I committed a mortal sin. And according to the book, mortal sins was murder, rape, and adultery. I was less than 6 years old. I'd already hit the big time. I didn't even know how to do those things, but you know, I became a willing student later on in life. So I had a lot of guilt, and you know, I never told anybody about that peanut until I got to AA. And, I found people I could trust, you know. And you know what? When I told you about that peanut, you told me about eating hot dogs on Friday. And so, anyway, I found my people. Had this guilt, man. I had a lot of self-pity, and I had a lot of, you know, I don't know why, unless it's body chemistry, but I had a feeling I got a raw deal. I had that when I was real little, and I don't know why, but I had a feeling I'd been shortchanged, and someone had dealt me out a losing hand. That's something I don't know. I come from, well, the class I went to, I don't see any of them in AA, and I look around and I wonder why me, but then again I get to thinking, maybe this is the way it's supposed to be. And but I had these things, and I had this terrible feeling that I was less than, always on the outside looking in. And so I was around booze. That's the thing about it. There was always booze on the kitchen sink. And my daddy gave me a glass of beer on a hot summer day when he was mowing the lawn. But it didn't seem to do much for me. And when I was about 14, he started to die of cancer. And I was in parochial school. And I went from parochial school into public school. And the nuns weren't there to lean on me anymore. And my dad was too sick to shape me up. And you know, I just took off like a bird. I went into that public high school. I was real small, too small to be a football player, too dumb to be a scholar. So I just majored in being a jackass. I went in there, I'd do anything to disrupt the class, to get a laugh, get some attention somehow. I didn't realize it at the time. But I so desperately wanted to be part of something, I guess. And so, needless to say, I started flunking classes in the ninth grade, but I made it through the ninth. By the tenth, I was really bombing out. And by the time I got to the 11th, my dad died. I was 16. Hadn't growed any. And I had an older brother who's a merchant seaman, and he said that I should go to sea. I should become a seaman and help support my sisters and mother, who is still there at home. And so I become a merchant seaman. I was 5'2", I weighed 110 pounds. And when I went on my first ship out of Galveston, the officer I was to work for was disappointed. He'd been looking for some help. And I was so damn small, I was like a passenger. But you know, I think I looked around, I don't know, but I'm just guessing. I looked around and I probably wanted to grow up real bad. I wanted to grow up and be a man, and whatever that is. And so I looked at the guys that were supposed to be the men on that ship. And merchant seamen, I know this will come as a surprise to you, but they drink a lot. And I drank. First time I was in port, I drank. I was in France, and I got drunk, and I cried. I was a crybaby drunk. Always was. I was not a whistler or singer like my dad. When I drank, I liked to figure out the raw deals I'd gotten in the life, and to remember all of the bad things that had happened to me. And I used to, my family still drinks, and when I come around that house and they were drinking, they seen me coming, they hated it because I could kill off a party in 15 minutes. They were all trying to have a ball, and I wanted to cry about something, and I'd start a fight with my brother-in-laws or have everybody sobbing over something. So that's where I was, and I got on the ships, I got drank everything that was available, I tried everything, anything that had alcohol in it, all kinds of different brews and wines and this type of thing, whatever was available, rum down in South America. I got indoctrinated into the drugs, every kind of drug that was available. Down in Panama, we could go through the canal, and we could seem like we could buy a sea bag full of weed for $10. I was on a ship where the whole crew smoked weed, even the captain. We would miss our ports by 200 miles. No one even give a damn. In fact, that was an old Union oil tanker, and we called it the Marijuana Maru. And that thing, you could see it out to sea by the trail of green smoke coming out. I was, it's the funny thing about it, too. If you feel sorry for yourself, weed ain't a good go. No one is going to feel sorry for you if you're giggling all the time. And, that was another thing. I've always been lazy, and I never did learn how to roll a joint. Even my last drunk, the windows had to roll my cigarette for me. But I'd roll a joint, looked like a Tootsie Pop. Weed wasn't it for me. And then I took a lot. I heard I heard some people talking about amphetamines, and my wife called them diet pills, and we called them whites. And I took a lot of them. They were pretty good for a while. I could work like 3 days without sleeping. That kind of stuff. Sometimes though, some people would call out from behind lampposts, call out my name. And another thing I heard a speaker say, and I know it to be true, he said, taking whites is like going 90 miles an hour with your shoes nailed to the floor. I guess I didn't want to go that fast. I settled on the stuff that I guess we all eventually settle on, and that is the stuff that would knock me flat, that would iron out life. The heavy sedatives, or the, I got into heavy drugs, and finally booze. I learned about all of the stuff you could buy at the drugstores, the Cherokol, and Robitussin, alcohol and codeine. Turpentine, I loved it. I come into AA at last. They're drinking turpentine, sweet wine. I drank so much of that turpentine, I haven't coughed for 24 years. I think I must have burned out my coffers. But anyway, I have run with, and I heard Joan say too, let's get high, let's get high. I come from a generation where we want to get high, and everything that we could take or use, you know, let's get high, that was our war cry. And you know, eventually I couldn't get high anymore. That stuff quit working, and I think that's why a lot of us are here today, is the stuff don't work anymore. I think we'd still be out there if we thought we could get one more 15-minute ride out of it, but it ain't there anymore. And so I had less than 10 years, and I had that drug thing, which caused me, I tell you, that's hell on earth. I can't believe anybody would figure they're getting high using that stuff, tying your belt around your arm and shoving a needle in it. I had cigarettes burn through my fingers while I'd be on the nod and not even feel it. Now, that's not what you call exciting living. Yeah, just try burning yourself the cigarette. But I wouldn't even feel it. I was just almost comatose. And this was what I was stuck with for a long time. I eventually run out of ship because I had a bad habit of stealing off of the ship. And the union kicked me out. And also I had this fear. I used to score in a neighborhood that was all Chicano. And I stood out like a bandaged thumb down in that neighborhood. And I had that feeling that I was going to get busted. And I had a brother that was doing time. He was what they used to call them junkies. And I had that feeling that I'd go to jail soon, and I knew I'd do a lot of time. And I'm a very, very fearful person about jail. I've been in jail drunk, but that's easy, because a lot of times I bail out before I even know I've been there. But that wasn't true with the drugs. I knew I'd be there a long time. And so I had that fear, and then, you know, I had to steal. Not that I was against stealing, but, you know, a lot of alcoholics, and this is what amazes me why I'm here, but a lot of alcoholics achieved certain successes in life, and then booze cut them down. My sponsor is that way. My sponsor was a college graduate. He was third generation North Dakota wheat farmer, and he stood on his farm and watched them auction it off. He drank it up. Third generation, he drank it up. And, but he had achieved something in life. And, you know, that wasn't my story. I started at the bottom and I worked down. I never achieved anything. And, as a thief, I was an underachiever, too. You know, a lot of times from up here at the podium, the people that did run afoul of the law when they're drinking, they shot it out with the cops, and they pulled bank jobs, and they extorted millions. You know what, folks, I'm ashamed to say this, but my specialty was spare tires. And you know, one thing about it, the field was wide open. I had very little competition, and you know, it's hard to move more than one spare tire at a time. But that was my big escapade in crime. And I could get $10 for your spare tire, and then I would make it down to East Los Angeles to the handball court or Montevilla or Hazard. Those are the areas. And give the guy my $10, and he was going to go score for me. And sometimes he didn't come back. That's called getting burnt. And that happened a lot of times. Then I would have to wait 2 hours, 3 hours, and waiting for this guy to come back. And he didn't. And eventually I'd have to go back into another area and steal another spare tire. I was getting pooped. And that's hard work. And so I wasn't, the ships had quit me, so I moved into Pomona. And, you know, that's another thing. I never realized this until I started pitching from up here. Every time I went out to sea, my mom would move. And she'd move from El Monte to Pomona, but I went and I followed her. And I went out there, and, you know, I got a job, fire and boilers. The only thing I ever knew how to do was the fire boilers. And I went and started drinking because I couldn't sleep. And I drank just a half a pint, and I'd take a couple of reds, and I could sleep. I found out later on that ain't sleep. But anyway, I could shut it off, and I wouldn't let that mind work on me. I have a real guilty conscience, and it's tough to lay there all night long and review all those horrendous things that you did. I had a feeling that I made Adolf Hitler look like a Boy Scout. And this is the feeling I had. I was a dirty rat. And I had failed. And I had no courage. I knew that. And so, and then people around me told me too. But anyway, the drinking, when I started drinking, the word went through my family, believe it or not, that I had returned to normal. They had an idea I wasn't using drugs anymore, and I wasn't stealing from them anymore. And I was drinking like them. And so I'll tell you about my normal drinking. It lasted about 5 years. And the first 3 years was, I guess you call fun drinking, if you want to call that fun. I got drunk, went fishing, got drunk, went hunting, drank every day for sleep, and on picnics got drunk, ran around with guys that got drunk like me. And we was, looking back on it, we was the chest beater type drunks. We drank a lot of whiskey and we'd brag about it, how much we drank. And we'd brag about all this love we made and about all of these men that we'd beat up and all these bars that we had broke up. And it was all just talk. And you drink that, we're drinking sour mash whiskey, and I guess that makes you feel that way. But these guys were just like me. They were failing. And we were trying to be men, and we became more childlike as the days went on. My wife used to have to hang her underwear up. I was married to my childhood sweetheart. She'd have to hang her underwear up between two sheets so the neighbors couldn't see the holes in them. Yet I'd be down to some beer joint, beating my chest, telling everybody what how bad I was or how cool I was, you know. And they went without while I was sick with this thing, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I tried lots of times to quit. I couldn't last maybe a day, maybe 2 days. And I realized, too, even as a kid, I used to give up candy for Lent. I'd give it up for 40 days, right? 3 days later, I'm eating a Baby Ruth bar, and I realized I failed again. That's the way it was. I just didn't think I had whatever you had. I always knew you people had what you needed, and I didn't. So I went on to this fun drinking, and I got worse and worse with it. This was the fun that I had towards the last year of whiskey drinking. I would come home from work, sit in a chair, my wife would buy the booze for me because she come from a drinking family, and she figured, I guess that was normal. She'd buy me a fifth of whiskey and a quart of beer. I'd sit in that chair, and we lived in a shack, and I made good money. But I'd watch that TV from midnight on, drinking that whiskey and chasing it with beer. And I'd wake in the morning about 5 o'clock, and I'd still be in my work clothes. She had gone to bed. And I'd be watching that TV, and it would have that Indian test pattern on it. And I'd watch it for a while, I guess. Maybe I thought it was going to say something. But that was every night. And I kept getting weaker and weaker, less able to eat, throwing up more and more. I had a real weak stomach. And, of course, the poison I was putting into it, maybe it was just as well. But I had a sponsor, one of my sponsors, and he was talking one time about the Keeley cure, a cure they had for alcoholism in the 20s and the 30s. And they give a person that checked in there all that he could drink. And that if he said he was a bourbon drinker, they'd pour bourbon down him until he gurgled. And then they give him a shot of morphine sulfate. He'd throw it all up. And then start all over again. And that was their cure. They figured they'd make you so damn sick of bourbon that you'd never drink again. And you know, I was practicing that 5 years before I got to AA, and I didn't even know it was a cure. I take one drink of that sour mash whiskey and swallow the same drink 20 times. And I think that I had it down, and somebody had slammed a door or a car had backfired, and I didn't have it down. But on a station, I start all over again. And but that was when I was, I guess, having fun. And you know, the stuff started eating up the inside of my head because I was blacking out then. And I would wake up, and this time I wouldn't be sitting; I'd be laying. And there'd be broken glass, and there'd be blood around, and the furniture had been rearranged. My wife's face had been rearranged, and a lamp might be twisted into the shape of a horseshoe or something. And she wouldn't say anything to me. She'd stay away from me. And I had a little girl by then. And when she finally would say something to me, she'd say, "Are you proud of yourself now?" And that was my childhood sweetheart. And I said, "What happened?" She said, "You went into your King Kong act again last night." And she said, "You called me every filthy name under the sun." You know, I didn't know what was wrong. And you know, the book, when we read the chapter 5, when Maggie read chapter 5 and she got to the ABCs, that part that goes, A, that I'm alcoholic and cannot manage my own life. B, that probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism. Well, you know, I thought maybe human power could relieve my alcoholism. That's what I knew about it. I didn't know anything about it. But I thought maybe that I had too much of something or too little of something. Maybe they'd find out what was wrong with me and give me something to take. And so I started going to the doctors. And I had three doctors. One was a young doctor, he gave me antabuse, and I drank on top of antabuse. It was, you know, it's so lucky that I'm still alive. I didn't think he meant beer when he said don't drink anything. And then I had another doctor used to give me B1 shots. The minute he pulled the needle out of my arm, he had a hypodermic needle as big as a bicycle pump. And he put that stuff in me, and I could taste that cod liver oil. He used to shoot that stuff into me for 3 weeks and give me phenobarbital, you know, for nervousness. That's what the bottle said on the prescription, for nervousness. I always got nervous when I quit drinking. And, you know, I take those phenobarbital until I got so damn goofy that I get drunk again. I just didn't like that feeling. And anyway, the one young doctor finally told my wife, he said, "John's messed up his liver." And I looked like I'd eaten ate a sack of cement, and it hardened on me. And I was yellow in the eyes, and I couldn't drink the whiskey anymore, and I'd found my favorite, sweet wine. And I had turned the color of what I'd drinking. I was purple. And I didn't want to go in the hospital. But you know, when I started drinking wine, when I drank whiskey, I had to move around a little bit, you know. But when I started drinking sweet wine, I sort of become horizontal a lot. I spent a lot of time face down, and then I got a brother-in-law still alive, says that one time I picked a fight while I was laying on my back, and I figured that was the normal position to be in. But you know, I was drinking a wine that was called, you probably never seen it advertised. This wine was called Cucamonga Pride. And it was cheaper in Gallo by about 4 cents a gallon. And I come from an area that has a lot of wine connoisseurs. And about this Cucamonga Pride. He said, you know that stuff you're drinking, never seen a grape. They squeeze it, the first press, they get the brandies, the cognacs, and the good stuff. And then they keep on going down the line. Finally, he says, they got the stems and the seeds and whatever else has fallen into it. Meanwhile, they press it one more time, and then he said to get the alcohol content up, they zing it with ether. Well, you know, folks, to be honest with you, I never did drink for flavor. All you gotta do is drink one bottle of turpentine hydrate to know that to be true. Turpentine hydrate tastes like rotten oranges, but that ether used to put my problems to sleep, which was me. And so that's what I did. I drank that stuff, and I laid down a lot, and I cried a lot. I was sort of a whimperer, and I had gotten a raw deal, you know. And so, I only had a couple years of that. During that time, I was hospitalized, and this young doctor told my wife about my liver, and then they took me in there. And in those days, they didn't have any insurance that would cover drunkenness. He took me in there with this liver thing. And I went in there in October 1956, and it was very hot. And my mom was on one side and my wife was on the other. I was too weak to walk. They sort of helping me along. And I checked into that hospital. And I was in there 3 days and I couldn't hold anything on my stomach. He was going to cure me with a new tranquilizer called Spirene, I guess. And I couldn't hold it on my stomach. And I'd been honest with him and he wouldn't give me anything. Any narcotics that he'd have to use a needle with. And so the third day I was in there, I had a water cooler going in my room. It was very hot. And all of a sudden I started to get a football game over my water cooler. It was Minnesota and Michigan. And the announcer was Bill Stern. I can remember to this day. I don't know who won, but, you know, I listened to it. I didn't have a radio in my room, and but, you know, I was going to have the DTs, and the first thing distorted would be sound, and then pretty soon I'd see things. And, you know, they say you die in those things sometimes, and I imagine you scare yourself to death because I've become so frightened. And I turned that damn football game off and started getting marching band music. And then later on I got visitors come into my room and they didn't have any hits. That was about the only visitors I was getting. And about 3 in the morning, I jumped up and I started running, and I ran. I weighed maybe 270 pounds. I don't know how heavy I was, but I know I was really in bad shape. I was bloated up real bad. And I ran into a room. Now, this sounds like it was almost a script or something, but, you know, I ran into this room, and there was a man laying on his back, had a tube in every hole in his body. He'd had major surgery. And, you know, I ran into his room. The nurses were hot after me. They wanted to put me in restraints or something. And I knew I was going to be killed if I didn't get up and run for it. And this man talked to me about AA. Alcoholics Anonymous, he talked to me about. That was my sponsor, and I didn't know it. He'd been sober 5 years. And he said that he drank half pints. And he was older than me. I was in my 20s. He was in his 40s. And he told me some things, but I couldn't remember. I was so crazy that night. I was insane. I should have been locked up. And I could have hurt myself or somebody else. And but anyway, the nurses pleaded with the doctor. And I got a hold of him, and finally they gave me some formaldehyde. And I slept. And I had them again in the morning, but they weren't so bad. But guess what? The AAs had been alerted. They came to see my sponsor, Kenny, and he sent them to see me. And they come into my room and stare at me. And I just laid there guilty. What was I going to say? And you know, they told me I had a disease. I didn't believe that. But in 1956, the American Medical Association said that we do have a disease. We have a disease. And I didn't believe them. I thought they were trying to whitewash this thing. I know it was because I was a dirty rat. Because I had no character, and I had no willpower. And everybody told me this, you know. And so I didn't believe the AAs. And when I left there, I took a prescription for spirine. The doctor said it was harmless. And so I was supposed to take one of those every 4 minutes. I got that screwed up, started taking 10 every 4 minutes. I wanted to feel them. I always took stuff to feel. I wanted to get high. I couldn't get high. That stuff is crazy. Couldn't get high, couldn't get low. Just sort of hung there. I went to meetings. A meeting could have lasted 10 hours, wouldn't have bothered me any. I had peace of mind and serenity you couldn't believe. They told me to get something cold in my hand, and so I ate those red pills and drank Coca-Cola. That's all I remember about AA. And everybody started patting me on the back. They said, oh, what a beautiful job you're doing. We're so proud of you. And I didn't know what I was doing. My mother-in-law even said, I think it's so great that you could quit, you know, because my father-in-law was a drunk. And I didn't know what I was doing. And you know what, folks? I didn't have anything going for me. The book says, you know, I had no defense. And it was only a matter of time. I was like a kid whistling in the graveyard, you know. And eventually I drank again. I got around that drunken father-in-law, and he said, don't be a sissy, and that always rang a bell with me, you know, because I was into that chest-beating stuff, you know. And so I wasn't going to be a sissy, so I took a drink. 6 weeks later, I was down again. I started off with whiskey, but I was down again. The progressiveness of this disease. I didn't have a lot of drinking time left anymore. And so this time, no hospital, no insurance. Doctor couldn't bring me in there again. And so I went to a 12-step house. And 12-step houses in California, they get alcoholics get an old house. It sort of looks like the Adams Mansion. And they put rollaway beds in there. And then they wait for customers. And I become a customer. And they take your clothes away from you. And they give you a bathrobe. And they try to help you. And, you know, I'm glad I went through them. The first one I was in was called the Harmony House, if you can believe it. And you know what? I was there with the world's greatest lovers. And I was there with the world's greatest fighters. And I was there with men that settled the West. And you couldn't believe it. These guys had accomplished great things. And guess what? We was all in a bathrobe. And to hear them tell it, we were going to do great things tomorrow. We were just suffering temporary setbacks is all. But anyway, you know, I never had seen a man convulse before. And while in there, I sat alongside two men that convulsed, you know, and I seen another one. And seen one man die of cerebral hemorrhage. They call it brain explosion. And seen lots of DTs. And you know what, us he-men types, we had to leave the lights on when we went to bed. You didn't dare turn off the lights because then guys would wake up with those nightmares, you know. And mommy wasn't there to tuck them in. And they had to know where they were at real quick before they'd become too frightening. And so I'm glad I went through that because, you know, I got in on the tail end of what drinking does. I got in on the part that we don't like to talk about, and you don't see it in the newspapers, the advertising. They never advertise. You think that they have tried to sell our wine and show you a picture of the Harmony House with all of us sitting around in a bathrobe? And you know, they want to show you, you know, the guys are running down the beach with those honeys in bikinis and they're getting ready to cook up a bunch of lobsters or something like that, you know. That wasn't going to happen for me, I tell you. I wasn't going to make it to the beach. So when I left there, I got drunk. I wasn't going to do great things. I was going to go back to drinking and whimpering some more. And this time, I didn't have the wife. One of those drunks that childhood sweetheart and a little baby was gone. 3 years old. Little red-headed girl, pretty as you ever want to see, and I never raised her. Another man raised her. But, you know, I never did even feel it until I was sober a year, and then it tore my stomach out, it seemed like. I never had anything hurt so bad in my life. But, you know, I was so wrapped up in myself, I couldn't even think about them. I was so thirsty to drink and paid no attention to them. And so I moved back in with dear old Mumsy, and she's not too happy to see me. I left home at 16 and I'm back at 25. I'm a mess. And so the word went out because my mom was going to fix me, and that can be deadly too when people decide to fix you. And she went and told my, I had twin sisters still at home, beautiful girl. And she told my twin sisters, Dates, that I was not to get anything to drink. They were not to lend me any money. They were not to take me to the liquor store, and they were not to be drinking around there. You know, I'd be an 86. And so, in fact, my mom couldn't even drink at home anymore. I think my mom had to start drinking down at the bars. And, you know, we're a family that always had the booze up on the kitchen sink. Except for me, I always kept mine in the pillow. I liked it then. And so, I managed to get sweet wine every day, or turpentine, whatever was available. I could walk down to the drugstore and sign that little ledger and get the turpentine. 3 bottles. I had to go to 3 drugstores. And or buy a bottle of that Cucamonga Pride. And it didn't take a lot anymore. I couldn't drink a lot anymore. I had no more capacity. There were no more than 2/5 a day baloney. I drank a little bit and now I was on the nod. And so, two things happened to me that got me kicked out of there. Now, my mom would have stayed with me until I died. The Irish never call in outsiders to help with their problem. The worst thing you can do in that family is call the police. And they never do get lawyers for divorces. They kill one another, but they never. So they're definitely afraid of outsiders coming in. And so she would have kept me in the back bedroom until I died. One night in the throes of this thing, I begged her. I said, please put me in Patton State Hospital, which is a local mental institution. And she said, I won't do it. She said, it'd put a stigma on the Keith name. I couldn't figure that one out. I was dying, and she's worried about a stigma on the Keith name. And I couldn't stop myself. And so, anyway, the two things got me kicked out of there. And I found out later on the AA's had something to do with it. But one night I committed suicide. I couldn't take it anymore.
It was just, it was too heavy of a burden, and I cut my wrist with a razor blade. Not too deep. You can get hurt bad that way. By the time they found out I committed suicide, the blood had dried. Almost like a shaving cut. Anyway, the family got nervous, and that poor family didn't have a lot of money, but they went and got $50 together. $50, and they hired me a psychiatrist. And that was, they knew I was flaky. Now they drank, and they were hungover, and they went to jail, and they done all that, but they were drinkers, but they knew something was wrong with me. And so I got drunk that morning. I was supposed to see the psychiatrist. I drank a bottle of turpentine and a bottle of sweet wine. I combined the two. But they went and sobered me up. They made me drink coffee, and they made me go see this guy. And you know, this guy was a funny thing. It's a goofy story. My story is so goofy that sometimes I hate to tell it. But this guy that I was to see is somewhere in his history and had a terrible back problem. And he had had the choice of sitting down or standing up the rest of his life. I didn't know this, but anyway, he chose standing up. And fused his spine. And, you know, and so I didn't know I was so sick and messed up. And my mom says, "I'll wait for you." And I went to the door and knocked. He said, "Come on in." And I went into his office. And he was laying there, and the back of his head touched the chair, and his feet touched the floor, and no other part of his body touched. To be honest with you, I couldn't think of anything to say. I just, $50, and I just sat there and stared at him. And I couldn't figure out how he was doing that. I couldn't wait to get out of there. And my mom had gone shopping, and then she'd come back. And I got in the car, and she was sure, I guess, with $50 worth that I'd be all right. And she said, "What did he say?" And I said, "And this is what he said. He said, 'John, when I get your thinking straightened out, you'll be able to drink like anybody else.'" Well, you know, I knew it cost $50, and as rum-dumb as I was, I said, "Well, how long is that going to take?" And he said, "About 2 years." And, you know, I didn't have 2 years left. I only had about 2 weeks, and I didn't have any $50. So I knew it wasn't going to work. And you know what I love about this program? This program you people give me. As you said right now, you didn't say 2 years, you didn't say 2 months, you didn't say 2 days. You said, "Here it is, it's starting now." And it did when I surrendered to the idea that I couldn't drink, never would be able to again. And I had to find a way, and this was my only hope, and I didn't know it. I had a lot more drinking to do. I had one more thing got me kicked out before I really got to AA. I better hurry up and get to it too before I die up here. I heard one speaker say he got to AA the day before he died, and I know what he's talking about. I One day she said, "You're going to eat?" And I said, "I can't eat, Mom." She said, "You're going to eat, you're going to get well, and you're going to go to work." And I got sick right away thinking about that. I couldn't work. I couldn't even tie my shoelaces. I was so weak. And I knew that if I, and I found out later on, I almost knew, I could tell by the ultimatum type of command that if I didn't do it, I'd be kicked out. And you know what, this big E-man type, the John Wayne type, I was so dependent on that dear old mom, I couldn't take care of myself anymore. I drank to be a man and I'd become a small child. And so I said, "I can't eat." She said, "You're going to eat." And I started eating. She put 50 pounds of macaroni and cheese on a plate. And I started working on that. And I had been drunk on sweet wine. I didn't drink a lot, but every day I drank something. And I was working on that, and I worked on it, I worked on it, I worked on it, and I got a lot of it down, and she finally went to bed, and I was very sick, but I didn't throw up. I knew that would wake her up. A lot of times, I would throw up, like, around the clock and keep her up all night, and a lot of times she'd come in and say, "Why do you do this to yourself?" I didn't know the answer. I guess I should have told her I didn't want to miss out on any fun. She told me one time, she said, "You know, if a dog ate something that made it sick, it would never eat that again." And she said, "You keep going back again and again." And you know, I suffered the insanity of alcoholism. The insanity of alcoholism, she told me, was not that I did crazy things while I was loaded. In fact, I looked more normal when I was loaded. But, it was that I go back again and again until it killed me. It would finally take everything I had, including my life's breath. And so I lay down on the couch, and I was real sick, but I passed out. And sometime during the night, one of these young sisters, and she just recently had forgiven me, and it's been over 20 years. Just recently, we get along well together. I think it's because I hired her boy to work for me. And we talk now, but for 20 years, where there was just like an ice blanket between the two of us. But anyway, she came in with her date and woke me up. And as they rattled the door, I woke up, and I woke up super sick. And I knew I had to get to the bathroom super fast. And I got up and I took off the best I could, as fast as I could go. And you know, my mom had these asphalt tile floors. And you know, I threw up about 30 feet ahead of myself. And I hit that and I lost my footing. And I went by my sister and her date on my hands and knees. She didn't even introduce me. And you know, I know why I went by so fast. And you know what? That guy never dated her again either. I stayed up all night and I cleaned it up, you know, macaroni and cheese hanging from the ceiling, you know. And the next morning, my mom said, "We're going shopping." And she said, "I'm taking you down to the surplus store and I'm buying you a suitcase." And so, about it was I was being kicked out, and guess who told her to kick me out? Those sneaky AAs. They come and they told my mom, they said, "Mrs. Keith, you know, John, they never could drink it, so you're going to have to stay here and watch him die a day at a time." And she didn't want that. If I was going to die, she wanted me to die someplace else. she didn't want to be around. And so I got kicked out, and I had 3 more weeks of sweet wine drinking. That's the story in itself. I moved in with another wino. I went to jail one more time. And in jail, the judge told me not to drink anymore in San Bernardino County, or I was going to do 180 days up on the road camp. And so I walked into Los Angeles County, and I drank maybe, I don't know how much was left in a bottle of whiskey, maybe 4 or 5 fingers. And I drank that, and I knew I'd never quit drinking. I just knew I couldn't. I had no strength to quit drinking. I'd tried before. And I drank that, and that was March the 19th, 1957. And I never drank again. What happened? They called surrender. Where was the power that I was to receive that I wouldn't have to drink anymore? Well, I didn't know it was with you people. You know, they say if you break your watch, don't take it to a carpenter to get it fixed, because he'll send it back to you in a brown paper sack. They say, take it to the watchmaker. And you know, I kept taking this broken watch to the wrong people. And finally I found the watchmaker. And it was you people, the experts. And you know, that's why I know you're my only hope. Because I've been to all that human power, the business of no human power to relieve my alcoholism. I tried the doctors and the psychiatrists, the judges, the lawyers, the priests. And, you know, it was funny, when I got to AA, they were already here ahead of me holding down a seat. And they were in the same jam I was. And, you know, we had to find this thing, all of us. We had to find this thing if we was to have any kind of life. And, you know, at the end, I was settled for anything just so I didn't have to drink anymore. I had an idea if I only could quit drinking, life would be just tiptoeing through the tulip. But it wasn't that way. When I come in here, I quit the drinking, and then I had to find something. And you told me, and you kept telling me, I had to change. I had to find a faith. I had to find a faith, maybe as small as a buster's faith, but I had to have something. And you know, it might sound like I'm knocking the Catholic Church, but I'm not, because you know, if it hadn't been for my early training, I don't think I would have, it would have taken me a long time to fall to my knees. I knew there was a God out there, but I just felt like I was such a dirty rat, he would never do anything for me. And you know, it was a drunk that told me this. And I never will forget it. In fact, it's been drunks that told me everything that I needed to know in order to survive. And this drunk asked me one time, he said, do you love your daughter? And of course, I never raised her, and she was gone. But I did love her. I said, sure, I love my daughter. He said, would you wish anything bad for her? I said, no. Are you crazy? And he said, well, you know, your heavenly father loves you 1,000,000 times greater, and do you think that he'd be wishing you anything bad? And I said, well, what about all these bad things that are happening? And he said, it's your own willfulness that's causing these things to happen. And he said, the more you line yourself up with God's will for you, he says, the easier it's going to be. And you know, there's a couple of things. I had to learn a lot of things. But I had good teachers. And I had good teachers. I had men that had climbed out of the meat grinder. And they stuck around and waited for me to show up. And you know, that's what I try to do. I try to stick around and maybe to help somebody else climb out of that meat grinder. I've had some beautiful things happen to me. This right here is one of, I'll put it in my good memory bank. And every time things get going a little rough, I'm going to remember. I'm going to remember Atlanta. And I'm going to remember your laughter. And I'm going to be feeling good again, I know. But anyway, 5 years sober, I met my wife. I went into the fishing game club in Ontario. It's a club that had all these dead deer heads along the wall. And but they held a Sunday night meeting there. And my wife walked in a tight red sweater. And I had a spiritual awakening in the meeting. I she had and was willing to go to any length. And you know, this beautiful lady here, she says that I got her before she had restored the sanity. And that might be true, but we've been married over 18 years. And she gave me the little girl that I didn't raise before. I got another little girl, and she's up to almost 18. And she's pretty like her mama. And she also brought two boys into the marriage. And my wife is Mexican, and I'm Irish. Her boys are as brown as I am red, but I become their daddy. And they're raised up, they're big men now. One's in the program, and they're really beautiful boys. I get Father's Day cards from them. And you know, my daughter from the previous marriage, she's close to us now. And sometimes we go out to dinner. And you know, my daughter is a redhead, and my boys are both Mexican and brown. My daughter, between the two of us, is sort of olive colored, real pretty brown eyes. And then myself and my wife, we look like the League of Nations. No one can figure out, they're always looking at us like, I wonder what the hell went on there, you know. But I had beautiful things happen to me, and I've met some beautiful friends. 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, well, I had a business that was actually given to me. And I had to go to school and everything to get the license. I become a contractor. But the roofing contractor. Now, I got a complexion that's designed for living inside a cave. So, you know, roofing was not my first choice. I'd rather have been a brain surgeon. But I always wanted to go from A to Z without doing B. And I had to start doing B. But, you know, in this business, I was on the roof and I went off of it one day. And I want to tell you this because it's what's happening here tonight. I lit on my knee. And it was a cement driveway. I only fell one story, but I weigh over 200 pounds. And I pile-dried that knee into smithereens. And I didn't even know it was wrong. I never had a broken bone before. And the leg just sort of hung there. And so they took me to the hospital. And when I woke in the morning, my leg was hooked to the ceiling. It was so bad they couldn't put a cast on it. And when I woke in the morning, there was 5 AA members already in that room arguing about something. And you know, I was coming out of sodium pentothal or something, and I was in and out, but I finally fell asleep. And during the evening, 6 more AA showed up, and I woke, and they were arguing about something else. And that's the way it went for 7 weeks. I had cards come in from all the meetings. I go to a meeting every night. I love you people. I want to be close to you. I want to be with you. And so I go to a meeting every night. And these cards come in. And the nurses, they were going crazy. They couldn't figure out who in the hell I was. And just like myself tonight, I can't figure out who in the hell I am to be up here. But I had a friend in Atlanta, Georgia, and his name was John, and he heard about it, and he sent me out a basket of fruit. Must have been 40 pounds of fruit in this thing. It was so beautiful. It was like I got a basket this time when I got here at the roundup. But each piece of fruit was individually cellophane wrapped, and those AAs ate up every bit of that fruit. I never got as much as a prune out of the whole bag, you know. And they took the magazines home before I finished with them. And, well, you know, the doctor told me when I got ready to leave, he said, you know, he said, you got the kind of knee that happens to people that have motorcycle accidents. And it was smashed to pieces. They put it together with pins. And he said, I can't believe that you'd stay that long in traction, 7 weeks. And I know why I stayed there. It's because you people were there every day. The little old ladies that come in during the day, and we'd exchange recipes, that kind of thing. And then the working stiffs would show up in the afternoon, and then the people before they went to the meeting would stop by, and then they come in after the meeting. And you're in there, and you love me, and I didn't get nervous, and I didn't whine. I didn't do too much sniffling. I couldn't. You can't snivel in an AA meeting. And so when I walked out of there, I had a leg left. A little shorter than the other, but I could walk on it, I could still climb a ladder, and I could still work. And so I would say that AA, love, saved that leg. I owe you people everything. I shouldn't even be here. And I don't know how it's going to end. It don't... Right now, it don't make a lot of difference. I only have today. I've seen some good things. I've seen some bad things. I've seen men die drunk. I've seen men die sober. But I know that my training, what I had, I call basic training, was for one reason. That was for me to be of service. To be of service to you and to myself. And so I stick around. It's probably the only thing that I've ever been trained to do. And that was because I had cried so much, drank so much, and hurt so much, and didn't know what was wrong with me. And that was my training. And then I found you people. And so, I don't know about the time. I have one more story, and I'll get out of here, because I asked John when I got here about you people. And I asked George, and I asked Natalie, and John, and Glenn, and I kept asking because I wanted to find out what you was like. Because I'm a California boy. And, you know, I know what you're like. You know, you're just like me. You're alcoholic. And you're beautiful people. But this thing happened because you might say, well, all he had to do was find AA and then life was just a bowl of cherries. But, you know, it's not that way. I'm still growing. And maybe some of my problems I'll go to my grave with. But, this thing happened. I was asked to speak in a small desert town about an hour and a half away called Victorville. And it's on the other side of the hill from us. And so that particular night, I was real anxious to go. And I started this finger popping and gotta go, gotta go. And my wife was getting ready. And my wife was taking that an awful long time to get ready. And so I went out in the car and started up the engine. Just to let her know that I was out there and ready to go. And I left it a couple of times. A little long time ago, never honked the horn. That's suicidal. And so eventually she come out, and she was not happy. And we headed down the road. She didn't say anything to me, and I knew she wasn't happy because we're friends. We've been together so long. We've shared so much. We've been to so many AA meetings together. We're friends. But this time she wasn't being friendly. She was mad. And so we got over the hill, and she still wasn't talking. And a guy had told me how to get to this place. He said, go to the Bear Valley Cutoff, go to the Second Cement Plant, and Women's Club. Heck, I put that into my teen mind, no problem. And so I got out there, and by that time we're fighting. And she said something mean, and I said something meaner. And so we were tearing at one another. And I'm real good at tearing at people. And so I get out to where I'm supposed to be, and I turn where I'm supposed to go, and I couldn't find the second cement plant. It looked to me like Victorville was a cement plant. There was nothing but stacks. And so... no problem. Bright lights, Women's Club in a park. Hey, snap. Victorville, small town. We went to two softball games and a square dance, and she's not saying anything, and I'm getting really, I'm about ready to throw a tantrum, to be honest with you. And I know that I'm not going to get to talk. And my lower lip is sticking out, and I'm starting to pout. And so I see the time, and I says, son of a, if the hell with AA, The hell with Victor Bill, the hell with speaking. This is me. When it don't go right, I throw my little thing. And so I started driving like a maniac. And I started yelling at the people in this little town. I was yelling obscenities, if you can believe it, out the window. Cussing out anybody that would listen to me. And I caused it. But I went about to tell her about it. And finally I realized I can't talk, and I says, I'm going home, and I'm getting out of here, and I'll never come back. And I just put my finger out the window and flipped off the whole town of Victorville. And on my back bumper, I got a sticker that says, Easy Does It. My wife hadn't said anything, and finally she said, you know, the people behind us are probably wondering what you was like before you start taking it so easy. That stopped me, because I realized that I'm representing you people, and I knocked it off. I knocked it off. I quit being a baby. AAs have a tendency to straighten me out in a hurry. They call it hard love. And I knocked it off. I was supposed to be in the next town called Oral Grande. And someone went into Oral Grande and said, there's a some flake driving around Victorville with Easy Does It on his bumper. Looks like he's lost. And so they come in and got me. Just in time, I think Victorville had formed a vigilante committee. And anyway, I went ahead and spoke, and I got over it. And the next morning, I went out and I scraped that bumper sticker off. On my car now, I got "Live and Let Live." Anybody can handle that. I'm going to get out of here. I'll run out of time. But, you know, gosh, I could stay up here for a whole hour just thanking you people for how great you've treated me. It's so fantastic. I feel like a kid at Disneyland. But this was a, well, another thing I'd like to finish, too. I got to the ABs. I never got to C. C says that God could and would have thought. Well, where would I be seeking God? Well, my grandfather used to say he hung out at the Catholic Church, and he probably does. But for me, he hangs out here. And I know that. I feel him. And so this is where I look for him. I come to the meetings. I find him every time. And he's always here. And it says so in one of the prayers we say in California, where two or three are gathered, there you'll be in the midst. And I've come to find that out. And so if I, in the morning, the wife and me, if we're not fighting, we kneel down and we say a prayer. And we say, not my will, but thine be done. And if I say, not my will, thine be done, I better be at an AA meeting that night, because that's probably his will for me. I'm a drunk. But this speaker was from New York, and he said that an AA meeting, this isn't mine. Most of it that I said isn't. It's what I've learned. But this fellow is from New York, and he said an AA meeting is a celebration of life over death. He said it was a celebration over getting well, over being sick. And, you know, I like that. I like that. What else are we doing here tonight for celebrating? We're celebrating that we're not in that meat grinder anymore. You know, and we're clean and we're sober and we're loving one another. And we have a chance. And so, thank you, folks, for asking me to be at your celebration.